You've entered Bookstorm with Kristen Civiletto and me, Chris Storm. This is a podcast devoted to best-selling books that matter, books that make a difference. We're diving down deep with beloved authors about their stories. We're exposing hot-button topics and heartfelt themes, the issues that affect each of us in our own lives, as siblings, parents, partners, friends, as human beings. We're braving new ideas, fresh thoughts, hard lessons, and important truths. Those kinds of things that stay with us long after we turn the last page and close the book. Welcome back to Bookstorm Podcast, and we're very excited because today we have a brilliant Australian author who is joining Bookstorm at 10 p.m. in Australia. Kristen and I have logged on at 10 a.m. because we'll do anything to talk to great authors like this. We have Dervla McTiernan, and we're going to talk to her about her fantastic new release, What Happened to Nina. Welcome, Dervla, to Bookstorm.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for logging on at 10 a.m. I really appreciate it.
We're thrilled that you're here. And before we get started, I want to give our listeners a little bit of your bio because you've got a really incredible bio with some great accomplishments. Dervla is an internationally best-selling and critically acclaimed author. She has a lot of bestsellers. You've heard of them. The Murder Rule, The Sisters, The Fireground, among others. I just saw that Murder Rule is in development as a premium limited series at FX. Congratulations. That's very exciting. In addition, of course, Dervla has won many awards, including two Barry Awards, a David Award, Ned Kelly Award, and the International Thriller Writer Award, which we're big fans of. Congratulations on that. So you spent 12 years as a lawyer. Following the global financial crisis, you moved from Ireland to Western Australia, quite a move, but you turned your hand to writing, and we're all very happy that that happened. She lives in Perth with her husband, two children, and far too many pets, although we've only heard of a cat. Do you have more than a cat in the back there?
We have two dogs. We have a cat, and my daughter is 14, and she wants to be a zoologist, so we also have a snake. Oh. My husband has drawn the line at the snake. That's it. Any more pets brought into this house and I will be divorced, I think.
That's a fun house. So glad you're here with us.
Thank you.
Now, Dervla, we're here to talk about What Happened to Nina, as Chris mentioned. And I like to give our listeners a summary of what's happening in the story. And I promise I won't give away any spoilers. And if you want to add anything at the end, we would love if you did that. Now, in your story, Nina and Simon, we meet them. They are a beautiful couple. They're young. They're seemingly in love. And they leave for a weekend at Simon's family cabin in Vermont. But only Simon comes home. Now, Nina's family wants to know, where's Nina? What has happened to her? And it doesn't seem like anyone knows except perhaps Simon. His explanations do not add up. And Nina's family goes to his home. They start asking questions. They become very aggressive in the search for their daughter, calling the police, hiring a PR firm. And pretty soon, we've got all kinds of rumors and gossip and all kinds of things going on here. But in your story, you really explore this idea of how far will people go to protect those they love and also to get at the truth. Did you want to add anything to that background?
I love your explanation. No, that's perfect. I wish you had been here at the beginning of my whole promotional effort. I would have written that down, Kristen, and reused it.
Awesome. Next time I'm there.
Yeah, please, if you could, I would really appreciate it. It's the hardest thing, boiling your book down to 60 seconds, because you know all the details so well. And sometimes all of it seems important, but you've got to find that little through line that explains it to people, and it can be tricky.
Yeah, it's great. Kristen always does the best summaries. I'm very grateful that she does that because it is tough to do. And everyone says that. Well, let me say for our listeners, yes, it is an incredible mystery thrill ride. I'm going to talk about the very first chapter because right away I was snagged into this story. I couldn't put it down. The first chapter spoke in the voice of the missing Nina. She says, I guess you've already judged me.
I mean, not in public, because victim blaming is a bad look. But in the privacy of your head, some quiet part of you thinks, I was weak or stupid or both. Maybe you think if I just stood up for myself, if I just walked away, everything would be okay. Wow. I thought this is something we often do not want to admit that we do. We victim blame. We say, why did you talk to them? Why'd you go down that dark alley? As the author, why do we blame the victim? And does it make the solving the crime easier if we do? Or maybe it makes us feel safer because we think we wouldn't make those mistakes.
I think it's the latter, Chris. I don't think it makes solving the crime easier, but I definitely think it makes us feel safer. And I think that's the reason behind a lot of victim blaming. That's the reason we ask that question. You know, really, did she walk by herself to the car park at 9 o'clock? And, you know, people used to ask questions, what was she wearing? I mean, come on, what was she wearing? As if that's in any way relevant. But we're clutching at straws. We're trying to find an explanation. We're trying to make a brutal crime less random. Because if something is truly random and if there's no one to blame, then that means it can happen to us and it can happen to the people we love. And in this book, this beautiful young girl has disappeared and people want to blame her parents. They're encouraged gently in that direction, but they want to say, maybe the parents had something to do with it. You know, it's not random. Or maybe the parents are at fault. Their parenting, you know, was really flawed, and there were dark secrets in this family. Because if you can find an explanation, it just makes us feel a little bit safer.
You know, I didn't realize that we did that so much. And maybe also we love the drama of creating our own little more dramatic, suspenseful, mysterious story than the real one. But you know, I said, okay, even if you were a young woman wearing a swimsuit down a dark alley, it still doesn't give anyone the right to attack you. It's
And it
crazy.
doesn't explain it because, I mean, at the end of the day, a young woman, as you say, could be wearing a bikini at 11 o'clock at night in a dark alley, and a good person will either walk by or try to help them. You know, it doesn't explain. Attacks happen because attackers want to attack. It's got nothing to do with what we're wearing or where we are. But, you know, there is this human instinct to find an explanation because the randomness is scary.
So true.
Dervla, I want to ask you, you know, for parents, there's always going to be a time when we realize our children may have done something wrong. And there's a scene in your story where a parent, and I'm not going to say which one, knows that her child is lying. She sees a tell, she gets a very sinking feeling. And our first instincts are to protect our children when we find out that they may have done something or been involved in something they shouldn't have. How can we best balance our responsibilities to protect our children with our responsibilities to others?
Gosh, I think it starts really early. You know, I mean, the first time you get a phone call from daycare telling you that your child may have used, for example, inappropriate language, and you have to think, oh, where could they have heard that? And perhaps you need to change your own behavior and you know, teach them not to use the language. But and that's just a normal parenting response. But we've all known the parent who, for some reason, and it can be difficult to understand, they just cannot ever accept that their child could be at fault. And so as soon as there's a suggestion that their child made a mistake or did something wrong, they go into full mama bear, papa bear mode and they go on the attack. And of course, that's terribly counterproductive because the child never learns consequences or boundaries and it just stores up trouble. In fairness, in this situation, I don't think that's what's happening with Simon's parents. You know, the reality is his beautiful girlfriend has disappeared. She hasn't come home, and people are starting to suggest that he had something to do with it. So this is not a minor accusation. This is a really serious accusation. And they know their son, you know, the same way we know our kid. They absolutely know that there is no way that he could ever have anything to do with this. They know it to their souls, to the core bottom of their feet, you know? And with that belief, then comes the natural next step. I mean, if your innocent child is accused of something that could, this accusation alone could destroy their life, even if they're never charged with anything, what would you do? And I think most of us would go into that overprotective mode and almost justify any behavior because your innocent child has been accused. And if a crack comes at some point where you have to start to wonder, was I wrong? Could I be wrong? I mean, I'm not sure how willing people are to open their eyes to those cracks and doubts. I think it's, I really wanted to explore that natural human reaction, you know, of a terrible accusation and what we would really do if it happened in real life.
Yeah, that's an excellent distinction too, that when it's a matter of life and death, it's a lot more of a gray area, but the burden and responsibility is even larger, I think, ethically. And, you know, and I love what you said too about going back to the youngest years, because everybody who has kids, you're going to hear from a teacher that your child has done something. And with my four kids, I took this whole approach of, I'm not going to automatically believe my children. I'm going to listen and investigate. And I told my kids that right from the beginning, I believe in you as a person, but you know, we've got to face facts and reality and take responsibility. So
and
really,
it's such a tricky balancing act, because you want, you know, part of helping your child grow in character is having you know, faith in their, in what they tell you and trusting them. But at the same time, kids are kids, and under a certain kind of pressure, they and a little bit of exaggeration, we kind of form memories sometimes looking back that aren't quite accurate. You have to be willing to be open to the fact that they maybe crossed the line or did something wrong, and then teach them how to deal with that. But yes, it isn't always easy to get it right.
And aren't we selfish a little? Because we think if our child is running around the playground pushing everyone, everyone's going to think we're a bad parent.
Yeah.
Or even in the teen years, like we want them to be good because we're the best parent. Same thing with kids. Kids don't want to admit their parents are horrible because that they come from that parent. And then what does that say about them? Families
That's
are tricky.
So interesting. Yeah, I was talking to someone today about that from the parenting point of view, how this change, this generational change in parenting. And I think we do really sort of, you know, see that we see ourselves reflected in our child publicly. So we really see our child's behavior as kind of part of us and our social standing, which I think is kind of dangerous. But I do think you're right. I think kids also see them, you know, that their parents' behavior reflected in them, and they're very conscious of that. I hadn't really considered that before now.
Interesting. I want to talk a little bit about the media, because the public gravitates towards sensational stories. We saw it in your book, and one of the characters actually explained it. They came out and said, number one, the public wants to feel like they're in the know, like they're smarter than someone else. Number two, they want to have the latest twist or little bit of information that they can pull out when their smart ass brother, sister, friend, or colleague starts to talk. I thought, this is so true. This is why we love these sensational stories. It doesn't matter if that story is true or not. As the writer of this story, in which the media played a significant role as an influencer, how does the media help or hinder an investigation?
Look, I think we've all seen cases where the media has been helpful. You know, a lot of media attention draws a lot of eyes, and sometimes it'll bring out a witness who might have seen something or might know something that they didn't know was relevant to the crime until all of the stories blew up. So we've definitely seen that happen. And we've even seen sort of amateur investigators genuinely contribute to finding the truth, for sure. But I think that those cases are the minority. And in the majority of cases, a lot of the time, all of this speculation is dangerous and hurtful. I think there's been a blurring of lines between documentary, you know, and, you know, really high journalistic standard podcasting, where they really look at fact checking, and sort of a kind of a true crime entertainment, where it's almost presented like reality TV. And we're really encouraged to treat it like reality TV, to, you know, to join each other over a cup of coffee the next day and go, oh my God, did you see last night's episode? I'm sure it was the uncle. You know, we had a case here in Western Australia where a little girl, she was only 4 or 5, her name was Cleo Smith, and her parents were camping on the beach in the far north of Western Australia, which is a thing that people do here. And Cleo was taken from her parents' tent in the middle of the night. And I think within about 48 hours of Cleo's disappearance, the police had cleared the parents publicly. It said, the parents have had nothing to do with this. We are exploring lines of inquiry. But that did not stop the speculation. If anything, it gave it more life. There was a Facebook group with tens of thousands of members where terrible things were said about Cleo's parents. You know, she's definitely involved, and they've done this, they've done that, the other, based on nothing more than the fact that people didn't like the way they looked at the press conference. So much so that our premier at the time, Mark McGowan, went to the press and said, can people please stop saying these terrible things? Now, in Cleo's case, The police found the kidnapper. They were able to track him down. Cleo has been returned safe and sound to her family. The man who took her had no connection with her parents whatsoever. He had his own traumatic history and mental health issues. And so Cleo's parents' reputations have been entirely cleared, and they can move forward with their lives with, you know, with nothing hanging over them. But there are so many cases where we never find the victim. We never find out who really committed the crime. And all of this speculation follows people forever. You could Google somebody's name, and the first thing that might come up would be a whole Facebook thread where people are speculating that he killed his niece or something. And it's all treated like it's just fiction. And we're encouraged to think about it like that way because it's packaged up for us in the same way, you know, with the same sound bites and little snappy bits of music, but it isn't fiction. And I think, like with so much of online conversation, I think we probably need to just take a second and just kind of look at what people are saying. The fact that everybody else is saying it kind of normalizes it and makes it feel very normal for us. I think we all need to kind of reintroduce our filters again and say, do I want to be part of this? Would I actually say this on the street? Would I feel comfortable with this? Would I have felt comfortable with it 5 years ago? And maybe pull back and be a little bit more, you know, considered in what we say.
That's very wise of you to say that. Let's take it a step further. You could actually have a court case and be found innocent in a trial, and still the public believes that you're guilty, which we've seen throughout history. Do you think it's this degree of separation because we have anonymity on social media that we feel free that we can say things? I think this to myself sometimes. When I'm in a car, I may beep at someone, maybe yell at somebody who cuts me off. However, if I was in a food grocery store and someone cut me off with their shopping cart, I wouldn't be doing that to them because we're face to face. So do we have courage because we can hide behind that television screen or computer screen or iPhone?
Absolutely. And I did a lot of research on this when I was writing the book, in particular into sort of outrage culture online and what drives it. So the thinking is that it's really status related. So seeking status and earning a position of status in society is an evolutionary thing. You know, we're all primed to do that. And looking down on someone, feeling that small moral superiority, gives us a little tiny boost of sort of dopamine. It makes us feel better about ourselves for a very short few seconds, not for very long, but it does. So if someone puts a post up in the morning, and we have to remember that there are influencers out there who are literally making their living, you know, posting these things. So they're sitting up in the morning going, what's my Friday post going to be? Okay, I could post something understanding about this true crime case and I'll get 10 comments. Or I could post something that's kind of suggestive that I know something, that the mother might be involved. That's going to get 2,000 comments and I will get a bigger payment and I'll be able to pay my rent. So there's a major motivation anyway behind that sort of stuff. Secondly, the algorithm feeds us what we respond to. So it's for feeding sort of our lowest instinct, if you like. The thing that feeds the outrage is feeding our outrage, and it becomes this kind of vicious circle. And then the other side of it, which is something I kind of mentioned earlier, is the normalization factor. So they really have done studies seeing how quickly things become normalized. So I think we've all seen a shift. If we look at what we would have put on Facebook or Instagram or anywhere 5 years ago versus what we see now, 5 years ago, someone could put up a post and we would turn to our friend and say, oh my God, I can't believe she said that. And if the same post went up today, we wouldn't even blink. So it's just something about seeing everything shift together. We just get used to it and it feels normal, which is why I think, and it's not easy to do because it's all happening quite subtly. We're not really aware of it, but I do think we kind of need to become a bit more conscious of it and just take a second to step back and go, is this me? Do I want to, you know, do I really agree with what I'm about to post here? Maybe I should reconsider and not feed the beast.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Definitely.
Yeah. In fact, it's perfectly illustrated by the apologies being issued to Princess Kate this week by a number of celebrities who were feeding the beast and feeding into those rumors. And, you know, maybe now there's a little bit more of accountability. It's the first time I've seen that actually in a long time.
Yeah, agreed completely. First time I've seen it as well. And I do hope it prompts us to kind of just give it a little bit of extra thought. I mean, it's very difficult because the algorithm does feed it and it makes it harder to kind of push the other direction if all you're seeing is the same kind of thing. But I think if more of us just become a bit more conscious, maybe over time, it will shift the story.
Yes. Now, Dervla, I want to ask you about something else. Your story highlighted the strain on marriages when couples are just pushed to the brink. And here we saw where spouses were trying to unite. And again, I'm not going to give away anything, but they maybe reacted to situations very differently. And I wanted to ask you, you know, when we're responding to things out of anger or fear, it's very hard on a marriage and on a relationship.
Yeah.
Can you comment on that theme in the story?
Absolutely. I mean, look, for me, this story was always going to be about the parents, really, despite the title of the book. It's not so much about what happened to Nina. It's more about what happens with the parents afterwards. I always saw them as, you know, two couples, Nina's parents, Simon's parents. They're going on with their ordinary everyday lives, with their everyday joys and everyday stresses. And then this bomb goes off in the middle of their lives. And that bomb is Nina's disappearance. And from the moment that happens, they're not living in the same world that you and I are living in really anymore. They're living in a kind of a heightened reality with the spotlight of all this media attention on them. And they each take one little step off the path. And they each do something that maybe you and I might not do, but that I think is reasonable in the circumstances. But when they take that step, when Leanne takes a step, it provokes a response from Simon's mother. And that provokes a response from Nina's dad, which provokes a response from Simon's father. And from the moment Nina disappears, both sets of parents are engaged in this kind of path of mutual destruction. And only a week goes by in the course of this story. But I think by the end of the week, if you asked any of them, Leanne or Andy or Rory or Jamie, if they recognize themselves, you know, 1 week later, I don't think they would. And so that was the story I wanted to write. In terms of their relationships, I think one couple pulls together closer and another couple doesn't, but you have to read the book to figure out who's who.
Yeah. And I was struck by the bargains, so to speak, that these couples were each making with one another, the things they were agreeing to give up or not give up. And I thought that is so true in relationships. There's a lot of reasons why people stay together. And it may not always be love.
It may not always be love, for sure. And there's definitely some complicated relationships going on there, and more complicated in a way by the end. I wanted Nina's disappearance in a way to expose some positives, but also some negatives. You know, I mean, when we meet Jamie, Jamie is this very beautiful younger woman, and she really doesn't believe that her husband loves her. In her own mind, their relationship is somewhat transactional. I think in the course of the story, well, I certainly feel like it isn't really like that. Her husband's just not very good at expressing how he feels. Unfortunately, they're not really in the best circumstances to kind of repair their history. So I'm not sure it quite works out for them.
Yeah. Well, first of all, we have loved diving into this book with you. But before we let you go, Dervla, can you give us a little bit of a clue? What's on your radar? What's coming next?
Oh my God, I'm working so flat out right now. I can't even tell you. I am finishing a book which is due to go to my publisher on the 15th of April. I'm not allowed to say what it is because they're making an official announcement soon. And then I have another book that is raring to go after that, that I've got a basic early outline on that I need to deliver by the end of the year. And there are two film development projects kind of in various stages at the moment that I'm in discussions on. And so there's just a lot going on right now, but it's all really exciting and really fun. And every day I pinch myself and I can't believe that this is my job and that I get to tell stories for a living. It's the best.
How wonderful.
That sure is, especially as a recovering lawyer. So I'm going to.
Yes.
Now, I know our readers will want to connect with you. So I'd like to tell them how. You have a beautiful website. They can find you there. You are on Facebook. You are on X, on Instagram. And again, we hope that you come back and talk about your new projects that you have coming down the pipe. We are so excited for you. But we want to thank you for coming and joining us today.
Thank you so much for your time. I so appreciate it. You're very
now,
good.
Now go to bed now. It's like 11 p.m.
Yes, I will. Good night.
Take care.
Bye, guys.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Bye.
That was a lot of fun talking with Dervla. Boy, Kristen, there's a lot of hot topics, but one hits me the strongest. I'm just going to say it. Bad eggs. We call them bad eggs. Kids who are bad. There are bad kids out there. And parents protect those bad kids. Yep. In a lot of ways. While she's explaining that to me, I'm thinking, I could only imagine being a teacher and the stories that maybe they have to tell, going through all school grades of how they're trying to reform some of these kids. Okay, so let me ask you this. Do you think that certain people are, let's say, bad because they're born that way or because of nurture? They've been raised in a family where they have learned that behavior. Maybe it's both.
Yeah, and I also think that nowadays social media plays a huge role in shaping the way our children respond to things. You know, anybody who has more than one child, you realize that your children have very different personalities and they may be raised in a similar way. I don't know if that's possible once there's a sibling, but to the extent that of your ability, and they will be very different. I mean, my kids are completely different in terms of their temperaments, their interests, their personalities, which is wonderful. But I only had so much influence over that. So I had a piece of advice given to me from my nanny to my mother, and I have never forgotten this. And that was, do not be shamed by your children. Do not be famed by your children. And that was something I really took to heart.
I love that. It means, you know what, I'm going to say that what that means to me, let your children live their life. It's not your life. You live your life. Yeah. Let your children live their life. These are two different lives. Yes, you can be proud of them. Yeah, you might be embarrassed, but their life is not a direct reflection on only yours. I like that quite a bit. I had a friend say something to me once. I'll never forget it. It was my neighbor when I lived in Pennsylvania. She said several little wise things to me, and this was one of them. Don't say anything bad about your own child. The world is going to say enough bad things about them. You take their corner. And I love that. However, sometimes you do have to admit that your child needs help or better direction. So this is an interesting topic. Let's talk a little bit about marriage, parents, and how they can hurt a child's life or put them on the wrong course or damage them in some way. I liked how you brought up this marriage issue in your second question. What did you think about that?
Yeah, first of all, I think a marriage has to withstand a lot of strains. But when it involves your children, I think it's a special kind of burden that is placed on the relationship. Because, you know, as we saw here, these parents were responding a bit differently, and that put them on a path of either uniting a little more or separating a little more emotionally. And nothing hits you as a parent as when your child, their life is at stake or their well-being is at stake and your spouse is not on board or is going in a direction you think might hurt them even further. So I love that she addressed that subject matter because to me, that's as big as it gets.
And that you brought up a good point. So we have a lot of different types of problems in this world. Some are small.
Yeah.
And they're not life-threatening. We deal with those in a different way. But when you're talking about a life-threatening problem, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah,
I guess it comes down to you better do the ethical thing. You better do the moral thing, not the selfish thing or the thing that makes your child come out looking perfect when they're not, and it's going to hurt them in the long run. This is some tough advice, right?
Absolutely.
The one thing I have that I say to my husband all the time, there will be no one ever in our lives who will love our children as much as he and I do. This is one thing we have in common in a huge way. It simply could never be. And now that includes my granddaughter. There will be. Now, listen, I love all kids. I have 28 nieces and nephews. Now they're married. Now they have babies. I'm probably up to 40 by now. I truly love them with all my heart. I really, really do. But there's something about your own child. There's just something.
Yeah, you feel that protective instinct is real. No doubt. Well, I love talking about this book with Dervla. She goes deep both in conversation and in the book. And I think people will really enjoy that about this one. And I'd like to tell our listeners a little bit of a preview of what we have coming up. We've got some fantastic authors in our spring and summer lineup. Kate Quinn, Janie Chang are coming on together. Mary Kubica, Christopher Reich. We've got Amiko Jean, Bonnie Jo Campbell, J.D. Barker, Scott Carson, who also writes as Michael Carita, Kate White, Lisa Wingate, B.A. Paris, Hank Philippi Ryan, Ramona Ossibel, Jill Shelvis, Lisa Barr, and Patricia Callahan. We cannot wait to talk to these authors. We can't wait for you to hear these interviews. These were fantastic books. And listeners, we thank you. We are in 80 countries. We have listeners, all 50 states. We have people in 1,700 plus cities. That is because you are listening, tuning in, and spreading the word. We know that you love hearing these in-depth discussions with these authors. So stay on the radar with us. You can find us at bookstormpodcast.com, on Instagram, on Facebook, on X. We are on YouTube. And until next time, listeners, one of the best ways to brave the storm is to dive down deep into life-changing fiction.